Welcome to the League of Most podcast. My name is Zachary Strebeck. I am your host and resident game boy. Today I have two great guests. They're here to discuss working in the games industry. So welcome to Francisco Suki and Jan Steck.
Hey, how's it going?
Hello.
Great. So first was Francisco, second was Jan. Let's start with Francisco. Why don't you tell me a little bit about your background and how you got into the games industry?
Sure. So I'm Francisco. I'm a game designer at Shell Games in Pittsburgh, where I've been almost 6 years now. And I got into games. I love that I get to go first because it's kind of the same story as Jan.
Yeah, I was going to say.
So I went to school for telecommunications engineering back in South America. I went to CMU, Carnegie Mellon, and its Entertainment Technology Center, which I think you've had a couple guests in the past from there. It's a great place, great school. And I did my master's there, master's in entertainment technology. And I was lucky enough to be hired at Shell Games. So Jesse Shell, our CEO, teaches at Carnegie Mellon.
Okay.
And I was hired back when we were about 30 people in the studio, and we've been growing pretty rapidly and consistently, and in a way that's not necessarily typical of game studios, and a very stable way.
In what
no,
way?
No, in that there's no layoffs or massive layoffs.
Yes,
or it's more like a normal company in that you get hired, you can expect to retain your job as long as you do a good job. External factors are generally
the usual cycle is after the project is finished, right? They lay a lot of people off. Do you have
it can be like that? Yes, unfortunately.
Okay.
Yeah, but we're a little different at Shell Games. We do primarily client projects, so as long as we can keep getting the clients, and we do smaller teams, so there's a lot of concurrent projects happening. And usually you're just hopping from one project to the other, providing your expertise where needed. And I've been there since. And I owe my entrance to the industry to the ETC. And hopefully I can give some advice on how not to depend on grad school to get a job in the games industry.
All right, Jan, tell me a little bit about your background and how it's different from Francisco's.
Well, that last part's going to be hard because it's actually pretty similar. So I'm from Panama originally, and I went to school for electrical engineering there, but ended up actually focusing on telecommunications. So there you go.
Okay.
And when I graduated, I knew that I wanted to keep doing technically oriented work, but I did know that I want to work in the entertainment industry. And so I found the ETC, and I was the class after Francisco's, and I met Francisco there, and I did an internship at Disney Research in between my first and second year, and that was when I kind of discovered the joy of actually implementing games for a bunch of research scientists that were designing crazy hardware, and my job was to make games for them. Huh. And I kind of discovered, hey, game designer is a job that you can actually make a living out of doing. This is kind of cool. I went into the ETC wanting to design theme parks and like actually build hardware. Mm-hmm. But once I discovered game design, I kind of fell in love with it. Shortly after it, I was hired at Shell. I worked there for about 2.5 years, mostly on games for younger audiences. And I wasn't really looking to leave, but an opportunity came up at Toys for Bob, who've worked on a lot of the Skylanders games, right, for a character designer to actually design gameplay for the countless different Skylanders that they have. And because it was for younger audiences and I kind of wanted to give AAA games a try, I decided to apply, and I was lucky enough to get it. I was told that I was actually the very last person to interview. Wow. So, you know, last one I'd in the door, I guess. And I have been here for almost 3 years now.
Excellent. Well, that's great. Congratulations to both of you.
Thank you.
For getting into and staying in the games industry. So,
also, I would like your listeners at the end to write in and decide who has the hottest accent, if me or you.
That's probably my South Jersey accent, I think. People love it.
Sure.
Yeah, right. All right. So I have a few main topics that I wanted to talk about, but I mean, if anything comes up, feel free to discuss it and we'll get going. So first, one of the big questions that new and younger game developers have is whether or not going for a traditional education, college education, you know, we have master's degrees. Is that necessary? What do you guys think?
It's something I like to see. Yeah, sure. I'll go first.
Okay.
It's something I like to see on a resume. I don't care necessarily exactly what you went to school for. In fact, my interest is more piqued if it's something different, if it's something special. Mm-hmm. But I think my view is that college will give you a good opportunity to work with other people, right? There are two things that I look for in resumes when I'm hiring, especially entry level, is how good are you working with other people and how many games have you made? I don't really care how good the games are. That's kind of like gravy. Mm-hmm. But I want to know that you're able to go through the whole game making process, that you've made tough decisions. I want to know where those decisions have led. And I want to know that you can work with other people, right? So if you've been making many games in your basement, that is cool. You probably have the chops to make games, but it doesn't necessarily tell me you have the chops to work with other people.
Right.
But if you can show me work you've done, even if it's not necessarily game related work, in big groups, and you can show me that you're a team player, that is very valuable. So I'm not going to be the guy to tell you not to go to college. It's something that I like to see on a resume. Take that with a grain of salt, because I did not go to college in the US, and I don't necessarily know exactly what it's like and all the debt that it, yeah, exactly, that it can. So if you, let's just put it this way. If you can make a point during our interview that you have what I'm looking for and you didn't go to college, it's not a big deal that you didn't do it. The fact that you went to college often is a good indicator that you have some chops.
Sure. So what if they have a really good portfolio and they've been working maybe with mod teams or I don't know, just groups on various independent games that they've done? Does that seem like a substitute, or do you think that the college experience itself is something that's super valuable?
No, I mean, I think that would probably be good enough, right? If you can show, and in fact, if you've been working on mod teams, you can probably show it even better than if you had gone to college, right? Like you actually have the experience and you can show me the product to back up. Right. And you can talk, if you can talk intelligently about what your role was and how you coordinated with other people to make sure everything fit together, who were you getting your assets from, or who were you giving your assets to, or whatever, and that you can fit in that machine, the big game making machine, then that makes me happy when I'm interviewing.
Okay. Jan, do you have any advice for people, whether to go to school or to school for games specifically or anything like that?
Yeah. I have to say first, like I agree with everything Francisco said. The importance of being able to work in groups for a game designer cannot be understated. The game designer, at least in my case that I do character design, I am sort of the end funnel where all animations, all sounds, assets, and I have to implement that, right?
Okay.
And so it's very important to be able to have a personality that, you know, you can kind of keep people on the same page. And this is true for the other disciplines too, right? The animator has to understand a little bit of game design. The game designer has to understand a little bit of animation. And you know, when you don't just kind of have the personality to be able to resolve conflicts or just, you know, being cool about it, because if you're making games and you're not having fun, there's something wrong there, and you'll be able to tell in the end product. As far as going, like pursuing a formal education, I'm not, if you've made games before and you've proven that you can do the work and you have some experience either modding or making your own, you come for an interview and I get a good vibe from you, I don't really mind the college degree or not. It's a very personal thing, of course, but I can tell you that titles don't really matter. I mean, a lot of the game designers here, some have computer science degrees, some have there's a guy I think has a degree in biology. There's another guy who started off as an artist. Like, there's, you know, there's all kinds. So I think it, to me, it doesn't matter, but it may be a thing that can satisfy like an initial, like, kind of HR review. Like, if you submit your resume to a big company, like, it may be something that, even though the studio doesn't care, like an HR person will. Like, I can tell you that we, as a studio, we don't like actively go and choose like who we're going to hire. We actually get a list that has been already vetted by the publisher. So it's, you know, you have to impress them first, right? It's kind of hard to justify a college degree just to like justify an interview, but it's, I think it can definitely make things easier. I will say though that there's a lot of schools out there, like a lot of game-centric schools that'll graduate students, and they focus a lot on the tools, on learning the tools, but tools change every day. Like, if you don't learn proper game design process, it's, I mean, you're going to be kind of at a loss when you graduate, because the tools are going to be obsolete. So just kind of learning proper process, and whatever you go to school for, if making games is your end goal, my one suggestion is make games. And it sounds kind of dumb, but when you're in school, just make games, upload them to the internet. That's, anyone can publish a game. You can publish it to Kongregate. You can publish it on your own website. Mm-hmm. You can go to TIGSource. There's all these wonderful places where not only will your game be seen by millions of people, you'll get feedback. Like, people will actually be excited to tell you like things they like and don't like about it. And if you can talk intelligently about how you reacted to that feedback, like, did you react? Why yes, why not? Things like that. Like, I would totally want to hire you.
Yep, I agree too. And I guess it's kind of related, but how about when you market yourself to employers or other parts of the job market? So there's a ton of people looking for game industry jobs. So how can you distinguish yourself from them, and how do you get your name out there? Let's go with Francisco first.
Yes. So I'm in a similar situation to Jan in many ways, right, in that most of the resumes show up after they've been reviewed. I think the skill of networking, which in my opinion, the skill of networking is also tied to the skill of making stuff, right? Like, as you make stuff, you have stuff to show, you have stuff to talk about. And if you have a local community, if you have any big local studio, you would be surprised. I'm hoping this is true of every development studio. I know at Shell Games, we're very open. If we get an email from anyone that's like, hey, I'm developing a game, could I bring it in to show it to you guys? Or do you guys have a designer you can send to our school to give feedback or anything of that sort? Mm-hmm. We are always very open in providing someone and in taking a look at games and meeting people that are interested in the industry. And then if you make a good impression, then that means that your resume can get a little recommendation attached to it, right?
And I mean, are there other venues where that kind of thing happens rather than, instead of just reaching out directly to a studio, things like game jams and other extracurricular non-school related activities?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Okay. Can you talk a little bit about more about that?
Yeah. I mean, I'd like to tell you a story about a guy who worked here, super cool guy, brilliant designer. The way he got a job here a long time ago was he actually showed up one day, and he's like, hey, I kind of want to work on games. Can I hang out? And I think he just hung out and did random tasks here and there, and they didn't even pay him. And he was still in high school even when he was doing that. Fast forward a decade and still here doing awesome and one of the leads, you know. So it's I think everybody has a bit of a crazy different story of how they got into games. Yeah. I will say that a very popular path to get into games industry, especially AAA games, is to go through QA, quality assurance. A lot of the people I work with were initially QA. And for QA, really what you're looking for is someone who is, I mean, obviously good at playing games, because you need to be able to pinpoint problems and be able to reproduce them. And sometimes to reproduce an obscure bug, you have to go and defeat that boss in X amount of time with using this character and, you know, that type of thing. And, you know, just being very analytical like if you can play games and you can be very analytical and you can be very systematic, that is something that is looked for in that position. And so it's pretty hard work, but it's a good way to get your foot in the door.
So
for whatever discipline.
Sometimes I've heard sort of the opposite, where once you go in as QA or a tester, maybe they never see you as someone who's ready for bigger tasks. Is that not true?
I think it depends on the studio. I can attest that that is not the case here, because we have a lot of senior people that started out in QA. Okay. So, yeah, I think it really depends on the studio.
Now, what?
I agree. At Shell Games, it's definitely the like our QA team is very small, so it's not like we have a big QA team that like we pick people from regularly or anything like that. It's a very small.
Oh wow!
Studios, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, can you repeat that last thing?
I mean, definitely.
My internet connection is going crazy.
And they're great for meeting like-minded people. They're great for, getting your hands dirty. The shortness of the amount of time that they give you to create these games, it's super helpful to just get you focused and to finding the fun very early, mm-hmm. which is something that even more experienced designers, like we sometimes tend to forget. Like we come up with these wonderfully convoluted things, and we have to sort of like trim the fat until we kind of get to the core. But having a game jam, it kind of forces you to create a complete experience in a very short amount of time, and that's one of the reasons that I really recommend people do them if they're interested in breaking into the industry, because you'll meet people, you'll come out with a product, and if you can talk intelligently about the decisions that you made, like Francisco mentioned, that is something that is very impressive.
Right. I missed the beginning of that. Let me just tell the audience. But yeah, he was talking about game jams, obviously. So the question is, and actually, I know a lot of relatively successful indie games have kind of come out of game jams, right? So you workshop that idea, the core idea, and then build it into a real game later. It seems pretty common.
Yeah, it's definitely a thing that happens. And again, you get a lot of, depending on the game jam, you get a lot of visibility. And there's a game I love, I think it's called Titan Souls, the 2D one for Vita, where you like the whole game is like a collection of boss fights. But the shtick is you only have one arrow, right? And it came out of this game jam that had a theme like you only have one. And it's like, oh, you have one shot to like, defeat the boss. And it came out of there. It's a phenomenal game. I've heard it's done great on the Vita. I know all because of a game jam. So
I have a Vita. I should buy it. That's
such a good game.
Okay,
it's such a good game. Yeah. Wow.
So, Francisco, what else? While someone is in school, is there anything else besides just making games that they can do to prepare themselves for a game industry job?
I am a fan of broad teams and with different interests. So I know I am always drawn to people who have different hobbies that like different things. I love, for example, I was very involved in theater, right? So whenever I have that connection with someone that I'm interviewing, there's a lot of things that I learned in theater that I can then apply to game design. So I would say first, playing a lot of games, it's not a joke, right? It's not like we always say in the game industry, it's like, oh, I play games for research. Yes, it's funny, but it's yes, you also do play games for research,
sure.
Right? It's a thing. You want to have a big game toolbox. So it's always good when you can reference off the top of your head, when you can think of a game that did something similar that worked or didn't work. So using your time playing games, it's never a waste of time. It always helps. But also, sort of, I see it as broadening your scope, your interest in life, and finding the way back from wherever you ended up back to games, right?
Yep.
So whether it's art or whether it's theater, whether it's photography or whether it's writing or math or physics or biology, finding your way back to games so that then you have that extra aspect of your life to pull from when you're designing, that's something that I value a lot in a design team.
What about you, Jan?
Let's see. I think it's important, during the process of, making games, showing them to people and playing games and all that stuff. It's important, I think, to, develop a language in which you can use to talk intelligently about the design of the game. Cause I see a lot of people who want to be a game designer. Mm-hmm. You start off describing games kind of like a reviewer would do it, which is fine because, I mean, reviews are great because they, you know, you get a lot of good information about what you can expect from that game, right? But if you're talking about the game in terms of the game design, you need to be able to speak a language where you can describe how different mechanics interact with each other. Like if you can tell me why the water temple in Ocarina of Time was pretty terrible, and not just because it was terrible, but you can actually explain to me like why that was the case.
Right.
Then that is something that that will definitely impress me. Because if not, then it's you never start from the, you know, you never start making the super fun, exciting graphics and visual effects, right? You start from the ground up. You start from a very simple prototype. It's going to be squares and spheres and things. So that's one thing. And the other one is, I would say, learn how to use any tool. It could be Game Maker. It could be Unity. It could be Unreal. It could be any of the, there's countless out there. And you don't have to be as good as a programmer, because if you want to be a game designer, but it's important, I feel, for a designer to be able to present a quick and dirty prototype of an idea that they want to portray. Because if a picture speaks more than 1,000 words, a prototype speaks more than 1,000 pictures, I think. And that's an often understated skill to have, to be able to prototype something to show to people.
Right. And I guess that also helps you learn the limitations of and the capabilities of whatever tools you may be using, right?
Absolutely. And it helps too, because sometimes, you know, I'll get a random error sometimes that just, it's something unintelligible to me. Mm-hmm. And but I'm kind of sure what's causing it. It gives me a language to go talk to a programmer about it and be like, hey, I'm having this problem with this thing. You think you have an idea? And then I can give him a starting point to, you know, help me out. And it's super helpful.
Right. I agree. Okay. So let's say you've gotten the job, right? When you're working there, how can you stand apart from the rest of the employees, right? How can you really advance in the game industry? Francisco.
Be good at what you do and be awesome around people, right? So those are the easy answers. Right. So I'm going to leave Jan with the hard ones. So
thank you.
First, yes, you ideally, if you were hired, it's to do the thing that you do well. So do that thing well. That's very simple and very, very obvious. A specific of game design is, a lot of people think that game designers are there to come up with all the ideas. So it's important for you to remember that your job most of the time is not to come up with ideas. You will come up with great ideas, and those great ideas will end up in the game. But other people will also come up with great ideas, and it's your job to make sure those great ideas also end up in the game, especially when they're better than your ideas, right? So you are the expert at trying out the ideas and the expert at figuring out what's fun and what's not fun. And eventually we'll develop an intuition, and hopefully the people you work with will trust that intuition enough that sometimes you don't have to try some things, depending on many things. Right. But sometimes you know right off the bat, if you're trying to figure out which of two ideas is best, you know which one to start with, because you know that's going to be the best one. And maybe you don't even need to try the second one, right?
Yep.
But developing that sense and just keeping that open mind of, it can be easy when you're starting to think, okay, I have to come up with the best ideas, and then those have to be in the game. And then if you feel like your ideas aren't making it in, then you feel bad. But just to remember that that's not what you're there for. You're there to make the best game possible with all the other people, not right. to have your stuff show up.
Well, and I think this sort of ties into, remember back, you were talking about what makes a good candidate, right? And there are people that mm-hmm. have had to work in jobs where they've had to collaborate before, or they've done sort of collaboration. And this is a big part of collaboration. It's sort of a give and take, right?
Yep.
It's not always you. You have to realize that there's other people on the team and respect their ideas and try to implement them and make the best end product you can.
Exactly. And the people that usually when they've just started and you're like a week or 2 weeks or 3 weeks and you're like, oh man, good thing we hired this person. It's generally people that are, again, they show up like they want to eat the world, right? Like they, God, this is their break and they are not going to let go. And so they just show you right off the bat that they are good at what they do, that there's a reason why you hired them, and they are willing to collaborate and willing to be there all the time. And that, in, to me, makes a really big impression.
How about you, Jan?
Yeah, I would like to stress that, you know, kind of going the extra mile. Like, hey, if you're done with your job for the day or you've cleared out all your bugs, go talk to your lead. Go talk to the QA lead. It's like, hey, is there anything else that I could be doing? You know, right. Last game, when we were all done with our, or we thought we were done with all of our stuff, you know, a bunch of bugs started popping up on work that had been made a couple of games ago, which we still needed to put in this game, right? And, you know, all of us just kind of became this like bug fixing armada to fix things that, hey, you didn't cause it, but that's, it doesn't matter because, like Francisco said, you are there to just make the game as absolutely awesome as you can. And that is really your mandate. And the more you can do, the more proactive you can be, that's makes a great impression. And also, something about, and this is going to sound super buzzwordy, so I apologize, but something people call like a T-shaped individual. So you're super good at being a game designer, like Francisco was saying, but you also have these other, like if you can, like I used to do a little bit of sound design, so I have a good rapport with sound designers because I can kind of understand a little bit of how they do what they do. And so it's very easy for me to do that. But for example, a coworker, he has a good understanding with effects artists because he's very, very good at making visual effects. So it's those kinds of like extra tidbits of knowledge that you don't have to be great at it, but the more you understand what other people do, it's just really helps that collaboration process. And I'll give you a couple of examples. One is we have this character in the Skylanders Trap Team game. It's a little artichoke, runs around, shoots tomatoes with a tomato gun, right? And so every character has this like ultimate attack. And what I had him doing is, you know, he kind of shot like a comically large tomato that rolled and like just kind of steamrolled enemies, right? Fun. Okay. And then the animator looks at me and he's like, dude, he should totally ride that tomato. And I just started cracking up. And I'm like, dude, if you can animate that, I can have that up and running in no time. And I kid you not, it literally took 20 minutes for him to make a rough anim, for me to put it in the game. We had it up and running and we had a crowd of people around her. And it's like, holy cow, that looks super cool. And they were giving all kinds of crazy ideas and suggestions. And that, you know, and all it took is just like two people willing to compromise.
Yep.
And so, again, like Francisco was saying, the opposite can also be true. I had this character, a little guy on a tiny motorcycle. I was super proud of it. And I showed it to a bunch of people around me. And they're like, you know what? This kind of sucks. And I'm like, hey, tell me more. Why do you think that? And just started kind of jotting down notes. And it just turned out the guy kind of moved around too slow and they were expecting him to go a little faster. And that, you know, we made this simple tweak and it just became better, right? So just being open to other people's ideas and listening.
I totally agree. Okay, great. Actually, one thing we all have in common is that we've all worked in the educational games industry, right? I used to be an animator and a concept artist for... very small. This was back in the early 2000s for some edutainment games, right? So it's an interesting industry because I think that most people who are in the sort of mainstream AAA games industry don't think about the educational side of things. But what is it like? How do you like being in that part of the industry?
I think I'm the only one now that's still in it, and I can say I love it.
Yeah.
Jan, though, you still make games for primarily young audiences,
yeah.
Right, Jan?
Yeah.
Why don't you get started with the young stuff, Jan, and then I can drill into the educational stuff.
Sure. I think we have people of all ages who play Skylanders, but at the end of the day, we owe ourselves to our core audience who can be as young as, say, 6 years old, right? And sometimes it's common for us designers to try to come up with these like super intricate like ability interactions and, oh, you do this thing and then you do this other thing. And if you hold this button at the right time, then this awesome thing happens. And that's great if you're working on a game for older audiences that have developed a more refined taste. But really for younger audiences, make it fun, like focus on making it fun first. And if you want to add layers of complexity for whoever's looking, that's great. But at the very least, if that kid is spamming the button, it should feel just reactive and fun. And that's really it. Like, at least for our younger audiences, just focusing on the fun above everything else.
Yeah, I agree. Francisco, what about educating them?
Yeah, so at Shell Games, we pride ourselves in our what we call transformational games, right? It's not always education, but it's games that transform people for good, right? So the idea is you visualize your player as what their current state, and then you visualize them after playing your game. They are some better version of themselves. Maybe they learned something small, but no matter how small, if they've learned something that you want to teach them, then that hopefully is an improvement. It's something that makes them better in some way, right? So you focus on that. You focus on that. What is that effect, that small, however small or big maybe, positive effect you want to have on the player, right? And then once you know that, and let's say, for example, it's you want to teach algebra to 10-year-olds. That's okay. Your thing, right? Then you have to kind of like be very humble and understand that you don't know how to teach algebra to 10-year-olds. You know how to make awesome games. That's what you do for a living. You're a great game developer, but you're not necessarily a great 10-year-old algebra teacher, right? So what you absolutely always have to do is think of first who's going to play your game, in which context they're going to play it, and who are the experts at doing what your game wants to do outside of games. And you talk to one of them, you hire one of them, or you collaborate with one of them, and you make the thing regularly checking with them, right? So in this case, you would find an algebra teacher, and you would ask them, how do you usually teach this? What are the main challenges when you're teaching this? What kind of tool would help you teach this better if you were to teach it? Where do the kids usually trip up? What are the concepts that are the hardest to grasp? And then you base your game to solve that problem, right? And that's going to make things much easier for you, and that's going to eliminate the sort of guesswork of, well, I'm going to teach this one way that I happened to learn it, right? There's a great example of a game that I worked on at Shell Games, which was a game where I was trying to get kids to become a little better at spatial reasoning. I identified that in schools in the US, spatial reasoning is something that usually is not a lot of emphasis is put on it because it doesn't generally show up on standardized tests. Right. And so the kids who don't know how to do it never learn how to do it properly. The kids who do know how to do it are never challenged so they can become amazing at it. So I thought, well, I'm going to solve this problem by making this game that I would love to play and that I think would be a great way to get kids exposed to spatial reasoning. And the kids didn't really like it very much. It was a game that the people who thought like me, so one in, I don't know, 20 kids, 25 kids, would love it and would play through it, and they'd be like, they would just amazing, and the rest of the kids just would not. And this did not have nothing to do with it. And I never had that conversation with the teacher, right? I looked online, and I looked at whether the way I was translating my game mechanics to teach what I wanted to teach was valid, and whether that generally was considered a good teaching method, and it was. But it was also very boring to kids, and they were not attracted to that.
Campion is one of the kids who loved that game.
I know, because we're the same person, yeah.
Pretty much.
But you're much nicer. Yeah, sure. I would say definitely go through that process, right? Identify which is the change that you want to do and or affect in your player, and then find someone that's an expert at that, and you focus on making your game amazing.
Excellent. Yeah, I think it's an industry that's kind of underserved. I had a board game developer named John Covey on here that does science-based games that actually try to teach real science, but they're board games. And, you know, he also said the same. The industry is basically full of junk, and it's something where I think good games could really actually serve to teach people things.
Or transform them, as you say. Yeah.
And something about games that you wouldn't necessarily consider to be educational is that all games teach you something, right?
Sure.
And it may not be math. It may not be, you know, chemistry. But let's say Zelda gives us an example, because it's a pretty obvious one, I think. A lot of why those games are fun is because in each of the dungeons you go to, you're given a tool. You know, it could be a bow and arrow, it could be a hook shot, it could be really heavy boots, or, you know, who knows. But they challenge you, like they teach you the basic use of the tool, and then they challenge you to use that tool in varying types of scenarios. And at the end of the level, there's kind of like the final exam, right, which is the boss that just kind of turns the whole thing on its head, and now you have to use it in a completely different way. And so you just prove that you can make someone have fun by teaching them something, right? And obviously, you know, hook shots are way more fun than chemistry, maybe for most people, because I myself flunked chemistry like 3 times. But if you can find what it is that it's fun about learning algebra, about learning spatial reasoning, if you find what can be fun about that and you can translate that into a game mechanic, that's gold. That really is gold.
I agree. I recently saw a game. This is kind of a tease because I'm not really going to talk about the game itself, but it had a, just like you were saying, it has a central mechanic, but the creativity with which he was implementing it, and then the puzzles that you really have to think very outside the box to solve it, it was amazing. So I hope to have him on here soon. So I keep listening to the podcast and you'll hear about it. Okay. So one thing that is important to a lot of creative people is to do your own side projects outside of your full-time job. Francisco, I think you said that you do not do this so much, but I know Jan is definitely doing it.
Yeah, I'll get mine out of the way quick so Jan can go in depth. Right. So I like making games in my work time, and then when I come home, I like being creative in other avenues. So generally, writing is what I tend to do, and that's something that I think helps me in many ways. It helps me with storytelling, and it helps me with different parts of the game design. But even though the company would allow it, it's not something that I actively pursue, game making outside of my full-time job. Okay.
No, it's totally understandable. Sometimes you just burn out from making games. I get it. And the last thing you want to do when you get home is make more games, right?
Yep.
So Jan, how about you?
Yeah, it's interesting because I generally do have like little projects here and there. Few ever, you know, become something. Lately, like especially right now, we're working super hard towards a deadline for the current project I'm on, and it's hard to justify to myself when I get home, like I really want to work on a game. So I generally try to do things like cooking or running or something that is satisfying to me that doesn't have a screen because I just kind of need that, kind of escape that for a bit. But I do actually watch like movies and play a ton of games and et cetera. I can talk about a side project I'm actively working on right now. It's a board game called Shut Up. If you've played like Cards Against Humanity or Apples to Apples or any kind of like party card game, it's kind of in that similar vein. And I'm working on it with two of my best friends. But, you know, we're pretty much crawling in terms of speed at which we're doing this because we all have full-time jobs. We all work for relatively large studios. And it's, again, it's finding that time and finding the will and the discipline to get home and do it that can make it really hard. We're pretty lucky that all of the studios we work at have pretty clear do's and don'ts in terms of side projects. Mm-hmm. So it's a good thing before, you know, if you work for a company, be sure to find out what the rules are before you start working on something, because you don't want to find yourself in a position where you put all this hard work into something and now, you know, the company owns it or something like that.
Right. And often you'll be signing some sort of an employment agreement when you go to start working at a game company or any kind of tech company.
Yes, absolutely.
That agreement may actually assign everything, but it depends on where you are. Like, for instance, in California, they'll have you assign everything that's not covered by one particular part of the California Labor Code, which says that if you do something on your own time with your own equipment and it's not in the, I think the exact, using the knowledge or whatever, I'm trying to remember the specific language, but I guess the main important points are on your own time and with your own equipment. So that kind of stuff is exempted from those kind of employment assignment agreements of your intellectual property. The problem is you don't want to have to fight against that down the road. So generally what I say to employees is get something specifically carved out. So if you want to do a particular project, make sure that you get it in writing that it's okay to do that. Or it sounds like there may be some sort of written policies where you guys are working. If that's confidential, that's fine. You don't have to talk about that. But yeah, generally you want something in writing, not like your boss saying, oh yeah, it's totally fine for you to do that. That probably won't hold up and you have no evidence that it ever happened.
Yeah. I mean, I can describe the process I went through with the board game here. I'm not sure how much detail I'm actually allowed to say, but I can describe the generalities of it. And I think it'll probably be
detailed possible. That's
so this was a board game that we started when we were in grad school, right? And so this was kind of more than 4 years ago. So that's what I mean. We've been very slowly inching our way to actually launching this game. When I started working here, like you said, I had to sign a document. I had to list like intellectual property I own, things like that. Mm-hmm. And I did that, but we weren't really actively working on the project at the time. And at some point we made the decision and we said, hey, we really want to take this off the ground. And I talked to my boss and I'm like, hey, boss, you know, we're doing this thing. What do I do? And he's like, oh yeah, you know, here's all the info you need. And we actually have a pretty organized, like section in our, call it like our hub website that like every employee has access to. You can go look for information and stuff like that. There's actually very clear instructions on, you know, if you have a potential conflict of interest, you submit this form, the legal team, at the publisher, reads it, they approve it, or, you know, disprove or, you know, not approve it. And, after that, like, you know, we got a very nice email from, our legal department. It said, hey, we found that there's actually no conflict of interest because it's a board game. We work on digital games. Right. This is for like more like a mature audience, a lot of good reasons. And they said, you know, if X, Y, or Z ever happens, if you ever decide to do this or that with the game, then you need to run through this process again because then the situation changes. But it was very kind of amicable, super cool. They're really understanding. They've been actively working on those policies to make it even more flexible to the point where right now I can say that if you follow their rules, you can get away with pretty much any side project you'd want to work on and you'd own it. And it's some pretty good policies. So I'm really happy with that.
In my experience, the reason for these policies to exist is not necessarily to steal everything you're doing on your own. They don't really care. It's that you're not working on this stuff on your own and neglecting your main job. So I think they want to be able to vet that and make sure that they know you're doing some amount of side project and that it's not going to affect your full-time job that they are paying you for, right?
Yeah. And as I understand it, in addition to that, the other concern is not that like they don't want to own your thing or they're not worried about like you stealing ideas from their stuff because God knows their legal team is way bigger than yours. Exactly, right. But I understand that there is a concern about potentially the studio doing something that's too similar to a side project you're working on that they don't know you're working on. And that can get pretty nasty if there's no communication there.
Right.
So I do definitely think it's a good idea that just everybody knows what everybody's doing. And just, you know, if you work at a big studio, that's one of the compromises you make that working on side projects, it's a little harder because you have to go through a process. But I find that at least Activision has some really good policies for it.
Okay. Yeah. And you're sort of covered, right? Yeah. There's no question.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
That's good. All right. Well, actually, I think we're basically out of time. So I think that's going to do that for this episode. Thank you both again for coming to the show, Francisco and Jan.
Thank you for inviting us.
Yeah, thanks.
No problem. I had a great time. So since you guys are both working for people, I don't know. Do you have Twitters and websites and things like that? How about you, Jan?
Yeah, my online stuff is terribly out of date. I would say that. LinkedIn is probably actually a really good way to contact me. My full name is there, which is Jan Steck Russo, J-A-N-S-T-E-C-R-U-S-S-O.
Can you give me your social security number as well?
Yes.
Please. Just kidding. So, okay, LinkedIn. Francisco, how about you? Where's a good place to find you on the
internet? You can find me on Twitter at FJSouki, that's FJSOUKI, okay. Or you can go to myclones.tumblr.com for a collection of people that look like me but are not me.
Wow. All right, and you can find me at gamelawyerblog.com. There you can read more about the legal aspects of game development, which actually it may show up as having malware now because it redirects to my site, and there used to be malware on my site, and I think Google still thinks that it's there. It's kind of a nightmare. Otherwise, make sure to go to iTunes, put a 5-star review on there, and go to our Patreon at patreon.com/legalmoves to donate to the campaign. And that is it for this week. I will see you all next week.